This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 43. And today we are talking about yoga, psychedelics, and American mental health. And we're bringing back to the pod what is now our resident historian, Dr. Lucas Reichert. And I'm very excited to have him here talking about his most recent article, Supple Bodies, Healthy Minds, Yoga, Psychedelics, and American Mental Health. And we're going to basically kind of interrogate, go through, look at the history of yoga and psychedelics. And what I didn't really know, they're a close link in our American history here and in American mental health, their use. So looking forward to that. I would have to say, in all honesty, I do have experience with psychedelics. It's been many years. For those that don't know, I'm actually kind of clean and sober. Have been, this is April 2018. At the end of this month, it'll be about 25 years since that I have been clean and sober. But prior to that, yes, have had plenty of experimentation with psychedelics and everything from acid to mushrooms, etc., and probably taking it for all the wrong reasons. It wasn't really about spiritual practice at that time in my life. Maybe some sort of surfacey or just kind of immature type, what I would describe as that now. But so I do have that experience, and actually have had profound experiences, both good and bad, using psychedelics. So, but I won't go into the gory details, but yeah, that's that. But I do want to share, because we also talk about yoga practice, non-psychedelic yoga practice in this conversation I have with Luke. And I never tell this story, but I'm going to start this podcast by telling this story about a time I've been teaching meditation now nearly 25 years, or a meditation practitioner, teaching more recently meditation, but practicing meditation now for nearly 25 years as well. And probably the first really formalized meditation instruction I learned meditation through a cassette tape on a Sony Walkman. For some of the older listeners, you'll know what I'm talking about. But I learned meditation via a cassette tape and a Sony Walkman, and did that for a while, and kind of worked my own practice that way. And then eventually realized I probably should go learn from some people that had been doing it for a long time. And then I found a Vedanta sect here in Southern California called the Brahma. Well, they're all over, but I mean, but they had a space here near my home in Southern California called the Brahma Kumaris. And I'm sure there's some listeners that might be familiar with them. And I think that they're one of the few, if only, Vedanta sect who ordains women. And all my meditation teachers, when I was there, the time I was there, there was this little ashram here. All my meditation teachers were women. So found them, went over there, decided I was going to learn from some pros, some professionals, and started to, you know, go there fairly religiously and partake in meditation instruction from these wonderful teachers. And there was one particular, the thing I want to share with you, there was one particular evening where I went to the kind of regular meditation class sitting, and one of the teachers said she was going to be doing this kind of practice. I wish I knew better what it was called at the time, and it was an open-eyed meditation, and we would focus on a particular spot or light or what have you. But she was going to do this open-eyed. We were going to do our open-mind meditation, and she was going to kind of go somewhere and then transmit it to us via eyes. So we were to look at her, and she was going to kind of go scan the room and look into our eyes kind of thing. And I know that sounds kind of, for the uninitiated, it sounds a little, maybe a little weird, but it wasn't. It was all pretty cool. Anyway, we were sitting there and I was doing my meditation. And I forgot, I was like kind of lost in the moment, so to speak, and I'd forgot I was supposed to be looking at her, actually. And when I remembered I'm supposed to be looking at her, I kind of looked up, I changed my glance, and I looked up and looked at her, and she was looking right at me. And I looked at her and caught her in the eyes, and language never does justice to these kinds of things, but I'm a practitioner of Zen Buddhism, but I know, and they have a saying, they call it Kensho, which is kind of this moment of insight or this awakening that happens. And I don't know what she did, but in that moment, I saw, I had a deeper and more profound experience that I never had in any kind of psychedelics. And I had some deep and profound experiences on psychedelics. But I just saw, the best I can describe is the world as it is, and just the interconnectedness of all of us, the sense that everything was going to be okay, and that we were just so interconnected. And it was lovely, and it was just awakening, and it was powerful, and it, you know, rocked me to my core, quite honestly. And and that was my non-psychedelic most powerful experience. And I haven't had anything like that since, after all these years of meditation practice, but nothing that has come quite close to that experience. But I do treasure it, and so I'm going to hold on to that. So anyway, before we, there's my story, but before we get to our guest, I want to just ask a couple favors again, like I always do, and that is, please, could you go to iTunes and rate and review the show? That is what I understand, help people find us. Just take a few minutes, please, and go just hit the button, give us a rating, or if you feel so compelled, even write something. That would be wonderful and much appreciated, and it would spread the word about the podcast. And I also have a couple of new videos up. If you have not been to the YouTube channel yet, please go to the Radical Therapist YouTube channel. Just posted, well, not just, but in the last couple of weeks, I had a burst of creativity and posted a video on why ask why in therapy, and then a video on the chemical imbalance myth. And I think you'll find both very interesting, and those are on the YouTube channel. So go, please, find the YouTube channel at The Radical Therapist and subscribe to the show, please, and hit the bell when you do subscribe so you're notified when new videos come up. I should have those here coming up pretty soon. So okay, so let's get to our show, and I'm just going to do a quick little bio of Dr. Lucas Reichert. Besides being the resident historian of the Radical Therapist podcast, Dr. Reichert is a Chancellor's Fellow in History at Strathclyde University. His first book, Conservatism, Consumer Choice, and the Food and Drug Administration, during the Reagan era, was about the U.S. pharmaceutical industry. His forthcoming book is called Strange Medicines, Science, Culture, and the Regulation of Drugs, which as soon as that comes out, I'll probably have him back and we'll talk about that. And also, finally, he is also the co-editor-in-chief of Social History of Alcohol and Drugs. So without further ado, let's chat with Luke. All right. Welcome to the show again, Lucas.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
Yes, it's great to have you back. I think at this point we can say, since this is your second visit to the podcast, that you are now the Radical Therapist resident historian.
It's an honor. Love the pod.
Yeah. Right, and for the listeners that might be listening to this, I think it was episode... Let me try and think. It's 22. Episode 22. You came on and shared with us The History of American Radical Psychiatry. And now you got a new article out, which I'm excited about, titled, and listeners, I will link this in the show notes so you have access to this, but the title of the article is Supple Bodies, Healthy Minds, Yoga and Psychedelics, and American Mental Health, that you wrote with, I think it's Matthew DeClout. Did I say that right?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's Matthew DeClout, but okay. Yeah.
Okay, and so... And this article, you do a few things. You interrogate the relationship between yoga, psychedelics, and South Asian and Eastern religion in USA mental health. You kind of take us back in time. And I think it's a really interesting time because I see both, well, obviously the yoga boom has been going for several years now here,
right,
in kind of a different way, but also now you're seeing psychedelics coming back in our mental health system. And I think, you know, things like microdosing, and there's some new experimentation going on with that. But before we kind of maybe talk about some of that, your latest article basically does a great job of taking us back through the history of yoga and psychedelics. And like I said, both are, you know, finding new life in contemporary therapeutic circles. And I guess I'm wondering, what had you looking in the direction of yoga and psychedelics at this time?
Mm-hmm. I feel like, Chris, you and I, we've been trying to find a reason to chat for eons now.
Right.
And it's great. I guess on a personal level, yoga is something that was part and parcel of the dinner conversation at home. So, you know, my partner has practiced and taught yoga at various times. So ideas like Ashtanga and Bikram and Iyengar, well, these are terms I've heard at the dinner table a lot. I've been tripping over yoga mats around the house since a long time now. But I guess on an intellectual level, I've been tinkering on a book about strange medicines for a few years now. One of the chapters is on LSD, and I also needed a superb collaborator to get going too, and that's Matt DeClout. So that's kind of what's brought me around in the direction of yoga and psychedelics. And, you know, I've always felt there's a deeper and trippier story about contemporary yoga. I think that story is, it's about religion, and it's about mental health, and it's about drugs, obviously. So, I mean, why it matters, I suppose, you know, understanding this history helps us understand about the current role of yoga in American life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think in your article, you describe kind of how things maybe haven't changed that much. In your article, you describe how in the 60s, Eastern religion, experimentation with yoga and psychedelics seemed a useful alternative to American capitalism, conservatism, militarism, racism, violence, and the prospect of nuclear war. But not only that experimentation seemed a useful alternative to other mental health strategies. And we're seeing that now, this drop in people attending traditional therapy, but this kind of growth in people seeking other kinds of, like, you know, I had a recent podcast with Dr. Scott Miller on psychics and mediums and those kinds of things, but now even psychedelics. But it seems like not much has changed since the 60s. We're still kind of in that, you know, people are looking for alternatives. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, you nailed it, Chris. I mean, it's what's old is new again, I guess. In a lot of ways, there's a lot of anxiety now about climate change. So the ecology movement in the 60s, and you've got this massive divide now between the rich and the poor in society. This is something that harkens back to the 60s. We've got all this war, whether or not it's Afghanistan and Syria. So militarism is still a dominant feature. And look, the very important Me Too movement.
Right.
The essentially the second wave or third wave feminism in the 60s and 70s. Look, MLK's death and racism, we just celebrated this. So like you said, what's old is new again. We're struggling with these issues. A lot of the issues haven't gone away. Now, you know, there's still a lot of experimentation. You rightfully talked about microdosing, and I've read about this in Wired, and I've read about this in The Atlantic and elsewhere. MDMA has been designated by the Food and Drug Administration as a breakthrough therapy for PTSD. I think you really, the question is really poignant about how we see these cycles from the say 1968, you know, 50 years ago. 50 years ago, the mental health services in the U.S. were up for grabs. We talked about this on my first podcast when you and I were here.
Right.
You know, you just have to think about Artie Lang and Dave Cooper and these guys who are calling to question maybe sort of the racism, underlying racism or colonialism that was built into the mental health system. Maybe they were talking about alternative strategies, basic income as a way of alleviating mental health. You know, social psychiatry was a major competitor for psychopharmacology in the 60s. And so, look, a lot's changed, but a lot has stayed the same, as you rightfully pointed out.
Right. And in your article, you detailed, and this was new for me. I actually didn't know this, and I didn't know it went this far back in North America. But in your article, you detail how yoga captivated certain Americans as far back as the middle of the 19th century, that even Henry David Thoreau famously called himself a yogi in 1849, which was quite surprising for me. Can you share with our listeners some history of yoga in the United States?
Sure. Yeah. So like I said, yoga has been a topic of conversation around my dinner table for a while, and it's always kind of intrigued me. There's loads of ways to think about it. And I try in the article to go after yoga from a few different angles. One of the angles is drugs, obviously, but another way of looking at it is through that lens of a fitness and a health trend.
Right.
So if you look at it through that lens, you know, health and fitness trends evolve. That's just the way it works. Technology and imperatives in business force certain changes. Consumers in health and fitness want fresh ideas. They want fresh products. So think Taibo with Billy.
Yeah.
You know, like or Thighmasters or Bowflex or there's loads and loads of examples you can think of. Mm. So yoga is only slightly different when you look at it through this lens. In 2016, over 33 million American adults reported having practiced yoga at some point in their lives. Mm. And a lot of studies bear out that it's positive for mental health outcomes. So you've got new condominium developments, senior citizens care homes and schools that are using yoga for healthcare purposes, but also, you know, to enhance learning and for economic purposes as well. So that matters what's going on right now. But when you look further back to like Henry David Thoreau, it wasn't nearly as cemented into culture as the way it is now. And so what Matt and I in the article try to do is trace that history. It's a long history, and you know, I'm not sure. Do you want me to try and hit the high points if I can? Or
yeah, maybe some of the high points, but save some for people to go seek the article, I guess.
Yeah.
We want them to read it too.
Yeah. Sometimes if I get talking, I won't stop, right? Yeah. So
all right. I'll put the brakes on you. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
what did you see as some of the high points of yoga coming here?
Well, I really like the name, the Omnipotent Om. A guy named Pierre Bernard from the early 1920s, who set up a shop in Nyack, New York. And the Omnipotent Om, who is, you know, a fairly wealthy chap, is catering to the upper crust of the Northeast in the 1920s. Mm. And at this point in time, the yoga is constituting part of a program that's focusing on health and well-being rather than religion. Mm. It's more of a health and fitness. It's got more health and fitness purposes than anything else. And, you know, you could make the case too that it was a form of conspicuous consumption
right.
in the 1920s. Yep.
And today, right?
Yeah. I mean, in a certain way, I mean, if you've got the best kind of yoga gear, you're it's like the best Air Jordans.
Sure. Yep.
So by 1931, a guy named Jagannath Goon publishes Asanas, a book that showcased yoga postures, helps popularize the postures for a wider American audience. And scientists, medical practitioners, and mental health practitioners start getting involved by around 1935, 1940. At Yale University, a guy named Kervir Bahan, who had studied with Goon at Goon's ashram, they start maybe doing some tests about, you know, does this create positive mental health outcomes? And so you begin to see more and more of a relationship between altered states of consciousness, religion, mental health strategies. And really from the 1940s, you begin to see a steady upward growth in the popularity of yoga in the United States. In the late 1940s, 1950s, yoga studios are opening shop across the U.S. from Hollywood to New York. So the marketplace begins to offer multiple varieties to cater to American consumers, offering up choices that addressed both the mind and the body.
Mm.
So,
yeah. And go ahead.
I was just going to say that maybe the highest point is in 1961, when yoga first appears on American television. It hits the airwaves. And, you know, we talk about this more in the article, and for fear of boring your listeners, I'll leave it there.
Yes, and they should read it because it is really fascinating history. And one of the things I took away actually too that I wasn't quite aware of was the closeness or the link of drugs and yoga. And I was wondering if you could say, and you know, particularly probably psychedelics. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about that, the history of that kind of linkage and the use of psychedelics in these circles, this both yoga and mental health circles.
Yeah, right. I mean, we talked a bit about the microdosing.
Right.
And, okay, so treating patients with psychedelic drugs may or may not seem bizarre to some of your listeners, but in the 50s and the 60s, expectations about psychedelics in mental health were sky high. So Hoffman discovers LSD in 1943. He draws attention from multiple fields, including psychiatry and psychotherapy. And doctors and scientists embrace LSD. Here in Glasgow, I go over and I visit Artie Lang's papers now and again. And Artie Lang, of course, was using LSD for many patients. by the mid-1960s, as yoga is on its upward trajectory, the biomedical community had published over 1,000 academic papers on the subject of LSD. Researchers were reporting positive results. Maybe not major breakthroughs, but we're seeing some good studies that are coming out. At the same time, though, Chris, other psychoactive substances are taking on a public image that has to do with the counterculture and anti-authority ideas.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's a bit of overcooked cliche, but the idea that LSD is associated with Charles Manson, with hedonism. So you're seeing more and more recreational abuse. So look, drugs are an important part of the 1960s as well. By 1980, when Dr. Hoffman, the discoverer of LSD, writes his book, and his book's called My Problem Child, he's talking about sort of all the wasted potential. LSD in 1968, again, 50 years ago, is regulated out of the medical sphere. It's no longer tested, and so this is just another angle, I suppose, on looking at yoga, the relationship between the two, and this is what we try to do in the article, is explore how LSD particularly and yoga kind of come together in the 1960s.
Yeah, and you kind of talk about, I guess you describe how yoga and psychology came together in more meaningful ways at the Esalen Institute, which is kind of legendary here in California, right?
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, and also you reference, and maybe this is time to talk about both these, this idea of some of the prominent spiritual teachers of the time, including Richard Alpert or Ram Dass, and Jack Kornfield, who's also very, both are very still teaching today, described psychedelics as a spiritual pathway that could be used as appropriate or inappropriate or inappropriate ways. And so I guess I'm wondering if you could kind of talk about this time of the Esalen Institute and then maybe some of these prominent spiritual teachers and their thoughts about, psychology, yoga, psychedelics.
Happily. So the Esalen Institute, you describe it rightfully as legendary. It's I think that it was established in 1962 on a stretch of land, Big Sur, California.
Yep.
So two Stanford graduates, Mike Murphy and Dick Price, started off as a small retreat, and they wanted it to be a safe space where individuals could explore human potentialities, and that's Aldous Huxley's term, human potentialities. I guess the initial vision, if you will, was, I don't know, maybe a more integration or expansion of humanistic psychology. Mm. Something that had to do with Eastern philosophies. This is holism. There's a holistic approach to wellness and personal transformation. And this is body, mind, and spirit. And this is what Matt and I are talking about in the article as well. Esalen promoted an approach that emphasized East meeting West. It was yoga was a big part of it. There was life coaching and encounter groups, and sometimes very hardcore, visceral encounter groups.
Right, right. I've heard stories.
Yeah. As far as I understand it, traditional dichotomies of mental health and illness were rejected at Esalen. And instead, you see the spotlight that's being placed on helping individuals create vital, meaningful lives. Holism, like I already said, was embraced dualism was thrown out the window. So you have all sorts of things that are in the mix. I mean, you've got gestalt, you've got psychodrama, you've got transactional analysis, primal scream, Merida therapy. So you have all these different therapies that are playing out, as well as Zen Buddhism and yoga. Mm. And last but not least, drugs were pervasive, according to what I've read.
Right. So
I think Esalen was fantastic for a number of reasons. Is liberated from any university, think tank, or religious organization. So it has this sort of autonomy, and it drew all sorts of mainstream characters like Joan Baez or Bob Dylan or George Harrison or Joni Mitchell, and I happen to be from her home province, or she's from my home province, however you want to put it. So I think Esalen was, I think it's really important, and that history helps us to understand yoga as well, because yoga was a big part of Esalen. Hmm. Now, the other question that you asked, which I don't want to ignore, has to do with Richard Alpert and Jack Kornfield, because here you're hitting on, I think, sort of a contentious part of what I've written, but also a really interesting part. So as far as I could tell, Chris, Alpert and Kornfield offered balanced approaches to the use of psychedelics in yoga. So you pointed out that that we make the case that there were inappropriate and appropriate ways of using psychedelics in mental health therapy.
Right.
According to them, this had a lot to do with safety and authenticity. So the safety of the LSD use and the authenticity of the experience afterwards. So essentially they agreed with the use of certain psychedelic drugs, but to an extent. It was balanced. On the negative side, there is a risk of burnout or, even the possibility of development of a mental health disorder with too much drug use. And this is, this is going to derail therapy. Mm. So Kornfield, who is a clinical psychologist and he's a Buddhism teacher.
Right.
He recalls his initial encounter with psychedelics after studying Eastern religion at Dartmouth College. So the way he put it, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but it's in the article, the majority of Western Buddhist teachers used psychedelics roughly at the beginning of their practices, the beginning of the practice in the 1960s. And that's because the drugs served as sort of a shortcut on the path to Buddhist heights.
Right.
A shortcut
right.
That was, it took a lot more work, a lot more effort through yoga, prayer, meditation to reach certain heights. And he also believed that, psychedelics together with ancient religious practices might be very fruitful for spiritual life and for mental health. So he and others in the field, on the downside though, worried that a dependence on psychedelics to achieve altered states of consciousness was ultimately problematic. So the idea that if you that just an excess, like I said, might stop you from reaching what you want to accomplish. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the degree of appropriateness or inappropriateness was situationally dependent.
Sure.
So, you're learning to achieve states of, altered consciousness through practice was more sustainable over the long term. It might've been a better thing to do for a majority of people, So that's what I mean by the appropriateness and inappropriateness of the use of psychedelics.
Got it. Later on, you describe a pushback to yoga and drugs that was centered on arguments about a cultural appropriation of Eastern spiritual language and metaphors. And I'm wondering if you could share a little bit more about that.
Yeah. I mean, we only have to think about Fanon in the 1960s, right, about colonialism.
Yeah.
And post-colonialism. So this is a tough one too, Chris, because I guess where we're coming from here when we write it is about the risk rewards involved in the use of psychedelics. The pushback to yoga and drugs centered on arguments often about whether or not there was some sort of cultural appropriation of certain spiritual language from India or elsewhere. So one Sufi spiritual teacher in India named Meher Baba opposed yoga psychedelic practices, the mixture of the two. In 66, he argued in an article called God in a Pill that altered states of consciousness and positive mental health outcomes that had to do with LSD were superficial. He made the case that psychedelics were harmful for the spirit. They were harmful for mental health. And he believed essentially that they were a shortcut and you were only going to achieve positive mental health through, you know, the hard work, the hard graft. And, you know, other gurus believed drugs could cause what they called spiritual dryness. Or disbelief. Some even said that they'd cause brain damage. A lot of Indian yogis in California and elsewhere had long valued altered states of consciousness, but you know, but some felt that drug-related experiences had had the potential to be inconsequential when it came to dharma. So that's one part of it, but another part of it has to do with cults.
Right.
And, so the whole cult side, where it gets kind of weird, a little bit strange. So in California, you have the Psychedelic Venus Church, which built drugs like LSD, into all of its religious activities. So the Psychedelic Venus Church had promotional materials in the late 60s, early 70s that called itself a pantheistic nature religion of hedonism. Let me just say that again. A pantheistic nature religion of hedonism. Yeah. So they'd circulate these on the streets of LA and San Francisco and elsewhere. To achieve greater peace of mind, to achieve enlightenment, some of the rituals included things like blind meditation and touch, nude group sensitivity encounters, nude yoga, cannabis communions, and so on. LSD was a big part of it, just like yoga was. Sorry, I'm going to swear on your podcast.
It's okay.
The leader of the church was Jefferson Fuck Poland. And, you know, he essentially said that he asked questions like, are the Hindu gods destructive? Are we being Easternized? And if we were, that was a positive thing. The Psychedelic Venus Church, it was repulsive to many mainstream practitioners of yoga. It was utterly repulsive to many, many health professionals, whether or not they were working in an ER or whether or not they were a psychologist or what have you. And I think probably they were right. But that's just one part of the story. In the 60s.
Yeah, there's a great, I don't know if you've seen it on Netflix. There's a great documentary I just watched. It's a 6-episode documentary on, it's called Wild, Wild Country, and it's on the cult, the Rajneesh in Oregon and Eastern Oregon. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember them, but it touches on a lot of this because they don't talk much about the psychedelics, but also some of the encounter groups that came out of Esalen was part of their religious practices. So for those that might be interested, it's worth a look and kind of, and judging by the cult you just described, it probably is kind of similar in nature. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, thank you for that. But I also want to ask you something, because in your article, you also touch on holotropic therapy, and this is moving maybe to non-psychedelic altered states of consciousness. And I actually see this making a comeback here in California. I've been seeing more and more kind of workshops, classes on holotropic therapy, primarily, I think, in some recovery, substance abuse recovery communities. And I was wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah, sure. We'll have to talk more about holotropic making its comeback. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
I actually have a couple of colleagues, historians, who did the holotropic therapy course and only reported positive things. But so Stan Grof, Stanislav Grof, who was at Esalen, came up with holotropic therapy, and the broad thrust of it was that with enough practice, one didn't need any synthetic substances like LSD or mescaline or what have you to achieve an altered state of consciousness. You could just achieve it through the right kind of breathing. You know what, actually, Chris, I remember this when I was a kid. I did this with when I was in grade 8 and grade 9 with some buddies, where we would just work on our own breathing to try and, I don't know, achieve some sort of high.
Yeah.
And anyway, Grof developed the breathwork program with his wife Christina at the Esalen, and it's based on the yogic practice of modulated breathing, and essentially the technique uses hyperventilation, to mimic the experience of a sort of non-ordinary state. So, you know, just think hyperventilating into a brown paper bag, if you will.
Right.
not to diminish what this is all about, but Grof contended that his therapy built a patient's character's armor. So the idea was to build up a shield or thick skin, if you will. Hmm. And this strengthened the body, this strengthened the mind, both. So holotropic therapy, it never gained a level of popularity as yoga. But it emphasized, and I think it's important that it emphasized non-pharmacological methods, so non-drug methods of reaching altered states of consciousness. It emphasized these as equally important in the treatment of mental illness. And in the treatment of spiritual emergencies. And I think that we shouldn't forget about that too. So by 1985, Grof is writing for the Yoga Journal. And in the Yoga Journal, he recalls how he had gone and dug into Eastern thinking to supplement orthodox mental therapies. That was kind of the reason one of the reasons he came up with this approach.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. And it is, I'm seeing, like I said, I'm seeing more of it here, and I didn't know much about it actually. And your article was really helpful in kind of explaining to me what it actually was. So, thank you for that.
you like the brown paper bag metaphor?
Yeah, it's good. Maybe I'll go experiment on myself and try one of these things soon. Final question. I have one last question for you, and I appreciate you taking this time. But you kind of end the article with this critique about, you know, kind of everything is for sale in America, including bliss. which I thought was a great heading. But I wonder what your thoughts are about consumerism and consumption involved in psychedelics and yoga back then, and actually maybe if you have some thoughts about what it, how it's going now.
I guess that criticism is in the article, yeah. I suppose that we got to keep our critical thinking caps on. We shouldn't just tune out.
Right.
Matt and I are telling, I think, a really positive story in the article. We're not negative about yoga and society, but at the same time, we should be thinking about what we're being sold. So there's a new computer out, the Lenovo Yoga, that's being advertised over here, right? There's cat yoga. There here in Scotland, where I'm living, there's kilted yoga, which is pretty self-explanatory. There's beer yoga. So you go to a studio and you drink a beer while you do yoga. So okay. So there's quite a few options that are open to the yoga consumer out there. What I would say is that we've adapted ancient beliefs for our purposes. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. Yoga is I think, a really important pathway for people to achieve positive mental health. And so they should have multiple options in the marketplace. But I go back to people like Mayor Baba, the guy who was pushing back against psychedelics and yoga. I mean, his problem was the quick and easy pathway to transcendence. You know, that quick and easy pathway to positive mental health, without putting the hard work in. The idea that, you know, if we're not happy with cat yoga, we can just go to kilted yoga. We can just switch it up. And right. So an argument, I suppose, can be made that with all sorts of drug options out there, there are all sorts of yoga options, too.
Yeah, it's like this is another conversation, but it's that treachery of choice thing.
I suppose, yeah. We're shackled by our own freedom in the medical marketplace. Look, I don't think that we're overly negative in the article, but what we are definitely saying is that both physical and mental health outcomes have emerged because of the rise of yoga. But we just need to make sure that we're aware of what we're being sold, what we're being offered.
Yeah, that's great. And that's a great place to end. Luke, I want to thank you for, again, taking the time. Sharing the article with our listeners. Listeners, the article will be linked. You should read it. It's awesome. But I want to thank you for taking the time. I know you're in Scotland, far, far away, and it's probably late at night there. And thanks again for... Oh, and if people want to reach out to you, how would they find you?
I think probably at Luke Rickard on Twitter is the best way to go. Okay. That's my handle.
Awesome. Okay. I'm still trying to figure out Twitter, but
yeah, me too. Yeah, I'm often feeling like a dinosaur.
Yeah, I know, but I'm gonna master it someday. We'll figure it out. I can't wait for your book. When your book comes out, we'll definitely have to have you back. But
yes, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I love the podcast, Chris. Yeah. Thanks so much for giving me this opportunity again.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for coming on. Well, that's our show, and as always, thank you very much for listening. If you would like some stickers or even a t-shirt, I think I got some t-shirts left, go look on the Instagram page, the Radical Therapist Instagram page. You can see an example of the t-shirts that I have and even some of the stickers. But if you'd like something like that, shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Would be happy if I got them to send them to you. So just reach out, let me know. And also we do have a webpage, theradicaltherapist.com. And I told you about the Instagram page. I'm on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. Go find us on Twitter. And I think that's all. Oh, Facebook too. Of course, we're on Facebook, The Radical Therapist. So go like us on Facebook. Go find us over there. Engage with me, please, in all those kind of social areas. It would be much appreciated. I like meeting and hearing and seeing various folks that are enjoying the show. So anyway, so as always, thanks for listening. This has been The Radical Therapist Podcast, and my name is Chris Hoff. Thanks again.